Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll have reactions to President Donald Trump's emergency declaration to fund a border wall and information on multiple lawsuits filed that seek to prevent that declaration from taking effect. From Sacramento, hear about a bill in the state legislature that would require local governments to post candidates' campaign finance information online for the public to easily access. The ACLU Foundation here in San Diego has filed a lawsuit seeking to force police departments in California to comply with a new law requiring disclosure of records related to police shootings. And in other local news, a witness in a civil trial is disputing Lemon Grove Councilman David Arambula's account about a meeting at his home that ended with the physical beating of a marijuana dispensary applicant, and we'll have details. On Crime Beat, the big news in East County this week is a federal gun trafficking investigation that has resulted in searches of jewelry store owner Leo Hamill's Hamul residence and businesses, and led to a sheriff's captain, Marco Garmo, being put on administrative leave as the FBI and ATF investigation continues. An arrest has been made in a stabbing murder case in El Cajon, and in Spring Valley, a jogger has died after being struck by a vehicle. Governor Gavin Newsom has ordered California's National Guard troops withdrawn from the Mexican border. And in more pushback against the Trump administration, San Diego County's supervisors have voted to sue over the mistreatment of asylum seekers who were being dumped on the streets of San Diego with no resources or support. On People Power, hear about SDSU faculty members, students, and friends who began writing letters to asylum seekers in the Otay Mesa detention facility. And now they've published the heart-wrenching letters on asylees' journey seeking freedom from fear, as well as a report documenting abuses inside the detention facility. Later, we'll be re-airing one of our favorite Best of East County episodes, taking you on the road to the Julian Fiddlin' Pick'em competition to hear some champion fiddlers performing. Plus, we'll have safety tips for you, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. President Donald Trump has signed a compromise bill to keep the government from shutting down again, but issued an emergency declaration Friday to build a border wall in defiance of congressional wishes. Both the Republican-controlled Senate and the Democratic-controlled House previously refused to allocate $5 billion requested by Trump for the border wall. The compromise bill signed by Trump does include $1.3 billion for border security, including 55 miles of new barriers. But under Trump's executive order, he would take even more money than he previously sought, over $7 billion that he hopes to divert from military construction projects, combating narcotics smuggling, and asset forfeitures. Now, asset forfeitures, or money seized from criminals, are currently used to fund police and sheriff operations that include substantial local funding in San Diego County. From 2004 to mid-2014, San Diego's sheriff and district attorney kept 80% of federal assets seized here, or about $1.5 million a year, according to our records request for a story that we broke back in 2014. If that money is diverted for a wall, taxpayers could wind up footing the bill here to continue funding the sheriff and district attorney programs currently funded through asset seizures. Trump insists that the wall is needed to prevent human and drug trafficking across the U.S.-Mexico border, despite the fact that Drug Enforcement Agency reports the vast majority of drugs enter the U.S. through lawful ports of entry. Critics point to the president's own words to argue that the issue is not a true emergency. In his speech at the White House Rose Garden, Trump said, "I could do the wall over a long period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it faster." He cited a need to combat what he calls an invasion of undocumented immigrants, suggesting many are criminals. But border apprehensions are actually down 76% from a record high 19 years ago, according to the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, And the number of undocumented immigrants is at its lowest since 2004, CBS News reports. The emergency declaration raises constitutional concerns. The Constitution gives funding power to Congress, not the president. Although past presidents have issued emergency declarations, none were made after Congress had refused funding for the purported emergency purpose. Past emergencies largely focused on military action or terrorism responses, such as after the 9/11 attacks. Senate Democratic leaders and some Republicans in Congress have voiced concerns over the president's actions and the precedent that could set, though other Republicans have defended Trump. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi warned that the declaration could set a precedent Republicans may not like if a future Democratic president decides to ignore Congress and declare an emergency to expend funds on a priority such as addressing gun violence. Congress could block the emergency declaration with a two-thirds veto-proof majority in both houses, although it's unclear whether there are enough members willing to directly challenge the president's authority to do that. Multiple lawsuits seek to stop the emergency declaration, including a suit being filed by California. The state's Attorney General Javier Becerra stated on ABC's The Week program, "It's clear that this isn't an emergency. It's clear that in the mind of Donald Trump, he needs to do something to try to fulfill a campaign promise." Three Texas landowners and the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental group, have also all filed legal action challenging the emergency declaration in hopes of saving habitat, including a national butterfly sanctuary slated for destruction on the border. Public Citizen has also filed suit, arguing that the action seeks to bypass the separation of powers mandated by the Constitution. Ultimately, the matter may be decided by the Supreme Court, which now has a conservative majority, including two justices appointed by President Trump.
How much money are candidates in your city or county getting in campaign contributions, and from whom? A new bill could soon require local governments to post this information online, instead of requiring members of the public to travel to a government office and look up hard copies, an option often not available to people who work full-time. Even if a city or county is willing to scan and email documents in response to a public records request, as some local cities have done when our media outlet has requested campaign finance documents, a local government entity can take up to 10 days to respond under the California Public Records Act. For campaign filings close to Election Day, voters might not be able to get the donation records in time before casting their ballots. Campaign contributions are already posted online for federal and state candidates in California, but a report by the watchdog group Common Cause in 2017 found that 70% of cities in our state did not post campaign finances online. Moreover, only 17 California counties had campaign finance data easily accessible online, according to a 2016 report by Stanford University. Hoping to change that situation, Assemblyman James Gallagher, a Republican from Yuba City, has introduced Assembly Bill 322. The measure would require all cities and counties statewide to post campaign finance records online, Cal Public Radio reports. In a press release, Gallagher states, "Voters deserve to know who and what interests are contributing to candidates at the local level. The bill is expected to get its first hearing at the state capitol next month." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
The ACLU Foundation of San Diego and Imperial Counties has filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit by several police unions seeking to prevent the release of police misconduct records as required by the state's new law, Senate Bill 1421. The ACLU demands that local law enforcement agencies act immediately to comply with the new law. Until now, California has been one of the nation's most secretive states when it comes to protecting police records, according to the ACLU. This landmark law, which took effect on January 1st, gives the public unprecedented access to records documenting police shootings, department findings of sexual assault, and lying by police officers, including planting evidence or falsifying police reports. In the new lawsuit, attorneys for police unions in San Diego, Carlsbad, Coronado, El Cajon, National City, Oceanside, and San Diego Unified School District argue that the new law does not apply to records created before 2019. Although the bill was intended to be applied retroactively, California Attorney General Javier Becerra has refused to release records prior to 2019, and some police departments even destroyed records before the new law took effect in January, according to the Sacramento Bee. His motion is filed on behalf of Flora Rivera, whose brother was shot and killed by law enforcement officers in May 2018. The motion seeks to defend the Rivera family's right to obtain police records documenting the shooting. Attorney Melissa De Leon says ACLU Foundation affiliates across California have sent records requests to law enforcement agencies on behalf of more than a dozen Californians who are still waiting for answers about the police officers who killed their loved ones. Norma Chavez Peterson, executive director of the ACLU Foundation locally, says this law is needed to build and strengthen trust between law enforcement agencies and the public they are sworn to protect. She adds, "All Californians have the right to know if their local police departments hold accountable officers who violate the law or department rules, or if these officers are being allowed back on the streets to do more harm." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
A witness has disputed a key claim made by Lemon Grove Councilman David Arambula in a civil suit filed by marijuana dispensary applicant Christopher Williams against Councilman Arambula and the city of Lemon Grove. Williams alleges that Arambula cut his face with a beer bottle, bit, choked, and punched him after a meeting at Arambula's home regarding Williams' dispensary applications. In an interview in March last year with East County Magazine, Arambula said he didn't know that Williams wanted to talk about a dispensary application during the July 2017 meeting. He claimed he met with Williams at the request of a political operative because Williams wanted to invest in Lemon Grove. Arambula said he merely wanted to learn about economic development opportunities. The councilman said that when he learned during the meeting that Williams wanted to discuss opening dispensaries, he told him it would be improper to discuss that and that he should go through the application process, then asked Williams to leave. But in a tentative ruling denying the city of Lemon Grove's request for a summary judgment or adjudication, Judge Richard Whitney writes that Taisha Brown, a member of a local political organization, stated in a declaration that she spoke to Arambula on behalf of Williams to set up the meeting to, quote, discuss cannabis dispensaries. According to Brown, she heard Williams and Arambula discuss the medical dispensary applications at Arambula's home. She says that Councilman Arambula showed Williams a briefing booklet he had received for the upcoming city council meeting. At some point, Mayor Raquel Vasquez was present at Arambula's home that night, though both Vasquez and Brown were reportedly gone before the physical altercation. The judge's tentative ruling denies the city's request to be removed from the suit. The city argued that the meeting ended at 8 p.m. and that all later events were part of a social event. But Brown says the meeting continued past 8 p.m. What happened later in the evening is in dispute. Arambula and Williams each claim the other was drinking heavily. Arambula went for a swim in his pool and says that after the two women left, Williams grabbed his shirt and told him that he needed to do as asked. Williams contends that he was assaulted, unprovoked, by Arambula, a former Marine, according to Arambula's Facebook profile. Councilman Arambula does not deny inflicting the injuries suffered by Williams, who was treated at a hospital. But Arambula claims he acted in self-defense. In his interview with our editor last March, however, Arambula denied striking Williams with a bottle. But Kim Oberecht, an attorney hired by Lemon Grove, told the San Diego Union-Tribune that, quote, "hitting someone upside the head with a bottle is startling, shocking, and unusual, and cannot be tied to any city activity, but rather to a social gathering at the councilman's home that lasted until close to midnight." The judge, in his tentative ruling, affirmed that it is undisputed that Mr. Arambula held official city business meetings in his home on multiple occasions, with Mayor Vasquez's knowledge. Further, Other members of the City Council also conducted official city business at locations beyond City Hall. An earlier claim filed by Williams against the city seeking medical expenses and punitive damages was denied by Lemon Grove, so Williams filed a civil lawsuit. He also claims the city has acted in a retaliatory manner against his applications, which the city denies. The judge is expected to issue a final ruling in the next week on whether the city of Lemon Grove will be included or dropped from the suit. At stake in the outcome of the lawsuit are taxpayer dollars and the political futures of at least two politicians from Lemon Grove. A San Diego Union Tribune editorial published last March, after Williams first filed a claim against the city, criticized Arambula and Vasquez for their actions in the wake of the altercation. The newspaper editorial board called it inconceivable that Arambula didn't disclose this matter before Williams' complaint to the city made it public, despite Williams having dispensary applications pending. If Vasquez knew of the fight but also kept quiet, that's also unacceptable, the editorial board concludes. Reporting for East County Magazine from Lemon Grove, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A federal gun trafficking investigation has led to the search of a prominent local jeweler's home and businesses, as well as an East County sheriff captain being put on administrative leave. Agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms raided the Hamel mansion of Leo Hamel, as well as several of his jewelry stores. On the same day as those searches, Sheriff Bill Gore announced that Rancho San Diego Captain Marco Gonzalez has been put on administrative leave as the department cooperates with the federal probe. Captain Gonzalez received a reprimand from Sheriff Gore in 2017 after it was found that he violated the limit on gun sales, selling more than the legal limit for 3 years in a row. Gonzalez claimed that he was not aware of the state law, and then District Attorney Bonnie DeManis declined to prosecute the law enforcement officer. Gonzalez and Hamel knew each other, having both served on the San Diego County Republican Party Central Committee. Hamel ran for the state assembly in 2016, seeking to represent East County, but he dropped out before the primary and yet still made it into a runoff election, which he lost to Randy Vopel. Captain Garmo has been replaced, for now, at the Rancho San Diego substation by Captain Charles Sinamo, who previously served in the sheriff's Vista jurisdiction.
This is Jonathan Getz. A man suspected of stabbing another man to death in front of two witnesses early Sunday morning in El Cajon has been arrested. El Cajon police officers responded to Grossmont Hospital, where they met with the victim's wife. She told officers that around 1 a.m. she and her husband, along with another man, were in their vehicle in an alley in the 300 block of North 2nd Street. Her husband reportedly got into an argument with another man outside of their vehicle, and that man stabbed her husband in the chest. The wife and the male passenger drove the victim to Grossmont Hospital, where medical staff pronounced him dead a short time later. El Cajon police detectives spoke with witnesses and identified a suspect. Around 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, a patrol officer near Wells Park in El Cajon found the suspect and arrested him. Lieutenant Walt Miller says, "Detectives are trying to determine why the suspect stabbed the victim and if the parties involved all knew each other prior to the incident. The suspect is an adult and has been booked into county jail for murder. The names of the victim and the suspect are not being released at this time, pending further investigative follow-up."
A jogger wearing all dark clothing was struck and killed before dawn last Wednesday morning in Spring Valley. The victim, a 45-year-old man, was running west in the eastbound lane of Hamishaw Road when he was struck by a Chevrolet Tahoe. San Miguel Fire Department and California Highway Patrol responded, but despite medical efforts, the jogger died at the scene. Alcohol and drugs are not believed to be factors in the fatal accident, according to Officer Travis Garrow with the CHP. The tragedy serves as an important reminder to always wear light-colored clothing, fluorescent clothing, or a flashing light when walking or jogging after dark, to assure visibility for motorists, and of course, always walk facing the traffic. Reporting for East County Magazine in Spring Valley, this is John Fistier.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Governor Gavin Newsom has ordered the withdrawal of most California National Guard troops from deployment at the Mexican border, leaving in place a limited number to enforce drug smuggling laws. Newsom rescinded an order signed by former Governor Jerry Brown. Brown had issued the order in response to a request for National Guardsmen from President Donald Trump, but Brown's order was contingent upon troops not being used to round up women and children or detain people escaping violence and seeking a better life. In his State of the State address, Governor Newsom said, "The border emergency is a manufactured crisis, and California will not be part of this political theater." His statement counters remarks by President Trump, who announced plans to send another 3,700 troops to the border in his State of the Union speech for what he characterized as a tremendous onslaught of migrants in border caravans. State Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins of San Diego issued a statement praising Newsom. It reads, "The only emergency at the border is the one created by the federal government's refusal to fulfill its responsibility to assist vulnerable families seeking asylum, and California is working with officials and organizations in San Diego to address that situation. California's National Guard troops are needed elsewhere in the state, and I stand by Governor Newsom's decision to redeploy them from the border to places where they will be of far more value to our residents," Senator Atkins adds. Newsom wants the president to redirect California's National Guard to support CAL FIRE, as well as intelligence operations targeting internationals in criminal drug gangs. Newsom's action follows a similar move last week by Governor Michelle Lujan Graham of New Mexico, who last week called for National Guard troops there to also be removed from border duties. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Miriam Raftery with a People Power Report. A new archive with hundreds of letters between volunteers and asylum seekers along the U.S.-Mexico border has been developed and is being digitized at the San Diego State University Library. What began as a casual gathering of friends has become a first-of-its-kind living archive of handwritten letters shared by hundreds of asylum seekers detained along the U.S.-Mexico border. Those letters provide a detailed description of each person's path to pursuing asylum and conditions inside detention centers. The idea started last summer with Joanna Brooks, an English professor and associate vice president for faculty advancement at SDSU, and Jennifer Gonzalez, a legal communicator with expertise in immigration. Together with friends and neighbors, they organized a grassroots group called Detainee Allies to provide support for refugees arriving in Tijuana from Central America at a time when more and more migrants were being held in privately run prisons. Brooks says, "We realized that hundreds of refugees were being detained at Otay Mesa Detention Center just 25 miles south of campus." Gonzalez and Brooks say they were saddened by the refugee crisis unfolding at our border and felt a need to do more. So along with colleagues from SDSU, as well as friends and neighbors, they found a way through the U.S. Postal Service. In late June, campus faculty and volunteers with Detainee Allies sent 30 letters to a group of refugees who had arrived from Honduras in May. A week later, they received over a dozen letters in return, providing a rare view into the immigrants' stories of migration, living, and working conditions. That was the start of the Otay Mesa Detention Center Detainee Letter Collection. What started as a basic act of human kindness has evolved to include dozens of students, faculty, staff, and community volunteers, exchanging letters over months with more than 220 people in detention. Some asylum seekers responded with original artwork made from materials inside the detention center, along with their letters providing firsthand accounts of detention facility conditions. Brooks, a professor of English and comparative literature, says the goals are to lift up the stories of people inside what she calls the black box at the border and to connect human beings to each other. This is what we all need now, she says. That letter-writing effort has also become a major research and archival project involving the SDSU Library, whose team is digitizing hundreds of pages from over 500 letters received so far. To support the library initiative, a new fund to digitize detainees' letters has been established on the library's website. On February 1st, student and faculty researchers released a new report titled Testimony from Migrants and Refugees in the Otay Mesa Detention Center. The report details troubling accounts of insufficient food, unsafe working conditions, not having appropriate access to legal representation, access denied to phones and mail, among other conditions. Some migrants describe feeling less than human and say that they would read letters again and again because they were the only connection they had beyond detention. Kate Swanson, co-author of the report and an associate geography professor at SDSU, says the letters provide a very stark view into the lives of asylum-seeking refugees and migrants now held in American prisons. She adds, letters from detainees who have been moved from San Diego to prisons in other states suggest that these conditions are not unique to the Otay Mesa Detention Center. The report has been shared with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and others, including California Attorney General Javier Becerra, who is investigating the conditions at all detention centers in our state. Brooks says stories from refugees show the humanity of people in detention as well as the vulnerability of human communities in the 21st century. While the letter-writing initiative began with individuals from Honduras, the collection now includes letters written by people from around the world, including Afghanistan, Brazil, China, Colombia, Cameroon, El Salvador, Ukraine, Mexico, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, among others. People from all of those countries have been detained at Otay Mesa. The public, as well as researchers, can now access the report and many of these letters online via SDSU Nbound, and that's spelled SDSU, the letter N, Bound. Patrick McCarthy, interim dean of the San Diego State Library, says the collection will provide valuable primary source data for scholars now and in the future. He adds, "Library archives play a critical role in democratic societies by collecting, preserving, and providing access to the written memory of humankind. We are committed to adding these stories to our archives because ultimately their stories are our stories," he concludes.
San Diego's county supervisors have voted 4-1 in closed session to file a lawsuit against the Trump administration over its treatment of families seeking asylum in the U.S. The federal government has been dumping migrants, including parents with children, on the streets of San Diego with no resources to help them while they await asylum hearings to which they are legally entitled under international law. For public health and humanitarian reasons, the majority of supervisors earlier voted to allow a former county courthouse building to be used to house the migrants temporarily until December and provide health checks for them. Some cited last year's hepatitis emergency, which started in the homeless population, as a concern, validating the need to take action. Board Chairwoman Diane Jacob, who voted in favor of suing the federal government, says the Trump administration created this crisis by releasing asylum-seeking families into our community without providing critical resources or even places to shelter. Supervisor Jacob says the lawsuit seeks to hold the federal government accountable for failing to consider the impact of its own actions on public health and safety. Supervisor Nathan Fletcher, who also voted in support of the lawsuit, says he hopes the courts will weigh in. But he affirms, "San Diego County will not abandon asylum seekers. We are committed to continuing our work with San Diego Rapid Response Network and the state of California to ensure humane and compassionate treatment for all." But Supervisor Kristen Gaspar, who cast the only vote against the lawsuit, and has previously stood with President Donald Trump on his immigration policies, criticizes the action as hasty and says it was made without giving staff time to do meaningful research or outreach to agencies involved. Gaspar states, "The gains we have made with regard to assisting our asylum-seeking families are now admired in a clumsy lawsuit that we have no chance of winning. I believe our federal immigration system needs major reforms, but I simply cannot put taxpayer dollars at risk for political posturing." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is John Fistier.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio,
89.1 FM, Descanso,
is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, listeners, we have a treat for you. My very special guest is musician Diego Rodriguez. Diego is an El Cajon resident who discovered the joy of music while he was a student at High Tech High Media Arts. He's attended Mesa College, and now he's working on getting his major in composition at UCSD. He has a band called Sweet Myths that performs locally, and he's now giving back by going out to local schools and introducing young people today to the joys of music. Diego, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, can you start by telling us a little bit about how you got started in your musical career?
That's a very long story. It pretty much started when I started playing guitar in middle school, and then eventually during high school, I wanted to pursue music even more. I started a band, and that's really when that desire for wanting to make music and make that more of a career started to blossom. Yeah.
Now, I understand that when you were a student at High Tech High Media Arts, there was a nonprofit that inspired you. Tell us about that.
So when I was in High Tech High, I had to do an internship program. And when I went there, I looked at A Reason to Survive Arts, which is a nonprofit organization that helps kids who are facing adversity. And they had an amazing music program, and I just wanted to help out. Eventually, after my internship program with High Tech High and Arts was over, I started to wanted to continue and coming back and try to help out with whatever they would let me help out with. I started helping out with teachers with music classes, and then eventually I became a teacher myself.
Now, you're also a songwriter, I understand. Tell us about what approach you take when you go out into the classroom. How do you get these kids motivated and inspired, and what are some of the things you do?
That's the million-dollar question, I guess. It's really hard sometimes because they start off being very introverted, very reserved, and I think it's been like operant conditioning they've been conditioned to really start just kind of be reserved, don't say what's on your mind. And what you try to do as a teacher over there is to try to kind of get them come out of their shell a little bit more, tell them that anything is possible, that all sound is legal in any case, and to try to just make something, and it's okay to mess up, because that's how we learn.
Yeah, sure. Creativity is so important in being a whole person. I know we were chatting before we went on the air a little bit about how this whole push toward technology, in some ways it's a positive, but in some ways it has maybe some negative effects on kids today, as well as the elimination of arts and music programs in so many schools.
Oh, absolutely. As far as arts and schools, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people don't really realize that arts is not necessarily like economically viable, or that you can't make money off of it. And I think that's why they cut them off. Whereas like math and science, or even even sports, they try to save, because in many ways there's this idea that you can become rich or you can become successful at those things. Whereas art, they just don't really see much like monetary benefits from that. And I think that's why they get cut a lot of the time.
What do you think are some of the most important elements that arts brings to a culture?
Neil deGrasse Tyson said this one quote that really stuck with me, and it's the fact that cities like Venice or Rome or any like old city has stood the test of time, not because of for their engineering or their mathematical formulas or their scientific discoveries, but it has to do with their culture, with their art, with their fashion, their architecture. That's why civilizations stand the test of time. And if you want to look at this from like a strategic perspective, if you want your country like to stand the test of time from many ages, even after the fall, you want to have a strong culture, a strong arts, artistic identity.
So what are some of the music forms that 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now people might look back on and remember as the American identity?
Hopefully jazz and folk music, bluegrass music, specifically with jazz, like John Coltrane or Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And like with folk music.
Music that tells a story, the ballads.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. My favorite bluegrass player, who's also just my favorite musician of all time, Chris Thiele. I think he's like such an amazing player.
That's great. So you and your bandmate DJ?
DJ, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I understand you go out into the schools and you do some really fun things from what I hear, like, you know, strumming ukuleles with first graders and leading drum circles in the elementary schools. And with the high school kids, you're even teaching them to write their own music. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So for my class, it's called Dots on Paper, and it's a songwriting class. It's run very similarly to a creative writing class in the sense of like you pick a topic and then you write about it, but instead you're using music concepts, maybe major and minor chords or chord progressions, or even just something abstract as ambiance or an emotion, rather than just teaching the music theory principles or music theory. I kind of wanted to get a little more abstract and see what they can come up with how to convey a certain abstract idea that isn't necessarily musical. You know, like
great.
Major or minor chords or rhythm.
And Diego, I understand that you're going to play one of your own songs for us today, something that you've written. Can you tell us about the song you're going to let our listeners enjoy?
Yeah. So this song is called All the Reasons. And I wrote it in a way that is kind of cynical. Like the lyrics are all very like cheesy. They're all like stuff that you would hear from a pop song or like a love song. But like I wrote it like lyrically, I wrote it the most cliche as possible. So it's kind of like a joke to like, you know, love songs and cheesy pop music, I guess.
Okay. Well, let's hear that rendition of All the Reasons.
Okay, will do.
Come by you. every time I look into your eyes, and not but from place to place. Every time I look upon your face, never looking back on the reasons I fell into little pieces. Songs out of me, it has come by you. Never looking back on the reasons I fell into little pieces. Songs out of me, it has come by you. I fell into little pieces. The song's out of me, it has come by you. Never looking back on the reasons I fell into little pieces. The song's out of me, it has come by you.
Well, you have a beautiful voice, and I can certainly see why the kids would enjoy having you come into the classroom, Diego. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
So what are the reactions you get when you come into a classroom and you've got these kind of reserved kids like you were talking about earlier, and they're suddenly exposed to music and getting a chance to be creative, some of them maybe for the, you know, for the first time?
Yeah, it's always amazing because the wheels keep turning, and they start turning in their head, and then they're like, well, what if I do this? What if I do that? And they start making like really creative decisions that I wouldn't have never thought. And that's kind of what I want them to do. It's more about trying to show them something and seeing what else they could do with that that maybe I haven't even thought of. And seeing how a lot of the students inevitably start getting those creative, the creative juices flowing, I guess.
Have you had any examples from the kids who've gone on to do something wonderful with their music?
Yeah, one kid that I know, he's very musically inclined. He has really good musical intuition. So what I mean by that is that he may not necessarily understand why it works, but he knows it works, and he knows what sounds good, even though like he may not necessarily know like the theory behind it. And so it's always nice. I always give him more challenges to be like, don't write this down. Just do it like as abstract as possible. Just use your intuition. And he always comes up with like amazing stuff.
So maybe he'll go on to a career in music himself.
Maybe.
Now, the piece that you played, you mentioned that you chose cliches intentionally. Mm-hmm. Why was that?
I'm not a huge fan of like love songs. I always hear like, I don't know, I have family that knows that I play music and write lyrics, and they're like, oh man, like, is this song about a girl? And I'm like, no. Is this song about a girl? No. Is this song about like, you know, this long, no, it's not about a love song. And so I just hear way too many love songs all the time. Yeah. So it's just like, it'd be nice to, you know, just hear something different or just joke about it.
So Diego, I understand that you've also introduced the kids in some of these local schools to classical musicians. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the program I'm working with is called Young Artists in Harmony, which is a program that goes to high schools in the South Bay and tries to bring in kids, commissions them to write a piece for a lot of classical musicians, the resident band being Art of Alon, which is a chamber music group with musicians from the San Diego Symphony. And so they get to compose pieces for these players, and then they get to play them, which is an amazing experience, which is not found very often in any music program that I know of.
Diego, can you give us a little example of one of the classical pieces that you play to introduce children to to the joys of classical music.
Yeah, this is Bourret in E minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Wonderful. It just sounds like you're doing some delightful things. I hope maybe someday you'll be able to bring some of those musical talents out here to some of the schools in East County as well.
That'd be great. We're always expanding, ever growing, so.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with El Cajon resident and musician Diego Rodriguez about the work he's doing to bring music into the public schools across our region. Diego, where can people find more information about you and this program?
The program, you can search up artofalon.com.
How do you spell that?
Art, A-R-T, of, Alon, E-L-A-N.com. And you can find me on Facebook or Instagram, Music by Diego Rodriguez on Instagram. You can also follow my band page, Sweet Myths, both on Instagram and Facebook.
And that's Sweet Myths spelled S-W-E-E-T-M-Y-T-H-S.
Yeah. And Music by Diego Rodriguez.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. Each year, the town of Julian comes alive with the sounds of music, fiddle music, along with banjos, guitars, mandolins, and mountain dulcimers at the annual Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest. Recently, we're seeing a revival of interest in the art of fiddling and, more broadly, a renaissance in traditional music both regionally and nationally. Avery Ellisman is the district representative from the California State Old Time Fiddlers Association, which started 40 years ago. Locally, there are now around 60 members on a mission to enhance appreciation for and involvement in old-time fiddling. He says there's been a huge bump in sales of acoustic instruments nationally, according to the National Association of Music Manufacturers. And locally, two major nationally known musical instrument manufacturers, Taylor Guitar and Deering Banjo, are both adding staff here in East County. Baby boomers have the money and the time to rediscover the joys of just fiddling around, a pastime that evokes bygone days when life was simpler and the pace of living was slower, with time to listen, learn, and make some music of your own. Ellisman says of fiddling, "This is the music of the people," adding, "One person sits with and teaches another." Fiddling is most prevalent in rural areas, also a popular pastime to while away time during inclement weather. It's what people did for entertainment, kids, long before the advent of radio, TV, or the internet. Ellisman says, "I consider music to be one of the highest forms of human celebration, a celebration of life. Fiddle music is infectious in a very positive way. The world needs more of that. Though played on the same instrument as a violin," he adds, "fiddle music calls you to dance." Julian's old-time fiddle and pickin' contest has its roots in a Julian banjo and fiddle competition that started over 60 years ago. For many years, it was run by the Julian Lions Club. But as the club's membership aged, interest in hosting competitions waned. The focus shifted to entertainment, and eventually the event dwindled. Ellisman runs the Julian Family Fiddle Camp each spring to teach fiddling skills to the next generation. So he asked the Lions to partner with his group and the State Old Time Fiddlers Association, but he says the Lions declined. So Ellisman turned to the community instead, asking the local Chamber of Commerce and local merchants to support a new and revitalized competition. The community agreed, and the competition has grown ever since. It's now a 2-day event, encouraging visitors to spend the night and help boost Julian's local economy. Ellisman calls Julian the jewel of East County, noting that the event draws people from across the West and as far away as Alaska. The first modern-day Julian Fiddle and Pickin' contest was held in 2014. Fiddling refers to bowed instruments, while picking is for unbowed instruments such as the guitar, mandolin, banjo, and mountain dulcimer.
Ellisman notes proudly, we have kids from age 6 up to age 86, and they're playing together. It's a wonderful way to bridge the generations. Before, Julian's events were not traditional fiddle contests, but now they are. Each competitor must perform three elements, a hoedown, a waltz, and a piece of the musician's choice, such as a jig, a polka, or something else. Competitors can compete in age-based categories or in an open competition that any age can enter. The open competition is considered the premier event, with bragging rights for winners who beat all comers. At the 2016 competition, Ellisman's 16-year-old daughter, Shira Ellisman, competed for the first time in the open competition category. Early in the day, youngsters competed, and then in the afternoon, the open picking competition was held, followed by the open fiddling division. Announcer Dwight Warden explained that the history of fiddling goes back to the 1700s in America. Thomas Jefferson was an avid fiddler. Fiddling gained popularity again in the 1900s, thanks to Henry Ford, who liked fiddling so much he had fiddle competitions in all of his dealerships. But then fiddling events shifted to hokum and show fests, with people playing fiddles behind their heads or beating on instruments with broom straws, Warden recalls. More recently, the pendulum has shifted back to traditional fiddling styles that popularized the genre to begin with. In the 1950s, a major competition in Idaho put the focus back on musicianship, and the modern fiddle competition was born. All three pieces must be played within just 4 minutes, and no hokum is allowed. Shira Ellisman opened up the fiddling competition playing Sally Johnson for her hoedown entry, followed by Morning Star Waltz and Don't Let Your Gal Go Down. And here's a little bit of what this talented fiddler sounded like. The local teenager's teacher is Luke Price, a graduate of the Berklee School of Music, who is also a two-time winner of the National Fiddle Championship. After Shira was finished, the announcer exclaimed, "She's got a future ahead of her!" The competition was stiff, with many other talented performers. After the contest, three of the fiddle judges also performed, Matthew Hartz and Luke Price, both multiple National Fiddle Competition winners, and Mabel Vogt from Idaho. Hartz told the crowd, "I'm excited to be here and come before a group that's so supportive. For us to carry this music and art form forward, we need your support," he added, as some in the crowd offered up donations or purchased CDs. Hartz performed a festival waltz and Shuck in the Bush to a wildly enthusiastic crowd. Here's a little excerpt of this dual national champion's performance. Finally, the long-awaited announcement of the awards winners came. First, the junior winners were announced, and then the open competitors. Tom Dillon of La Mesa, who plays with a bluegrass band, took first place in the open picking category. Then, the open fiddling winner was announced, and Shira Ellison claimed the top prize, beaming from ear to ear. Afterwards, her teacher, Luke Price, shared with us how he first got interested in music. My dad started me on guitar and banjo at 3 years old, he said, in between signing autographs from his fans. I started classical violin at age 8. It took me 2 years before I started exploring the fiddle genre. He said, adding, it took me 2 years before I started exploring the fiddle genre. He's come a long way since then, passing along the skills and joy of old-time fiddling to a new generation, including Shira Ellison, as she commences her own musical journey. You can learn fiddling and picking skills locally by signing up through julianfiddlecamp.com and listen to the talented local and national competitors at the next Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest by visiting sandiegofiddler.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barena for East County Magazine and KNSJ with some important safety tips. On average, 20,000 deaths and 21 million medical visits occur annually, Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna reminds us. Firefighters and paramedics respond to thousands of accidents every day, he says. Chief DiGiovanna, author of the Chief's Corner column on East County Magazine, offers these tips to help prevent accidents in your home. In the bathroom, cleaners should be locked away, out of the reach of children. Medications, scissors, razor blades, and cleaning supplies should be kept in a locked cabinet or out of the reach of children and pets. Non-skid stickers in the tub and shower can prevent slips and falls. Children should not be left unattended in or around the pool. Pool areas should be fenced in with a gate secured with a child-proof safety lock or latch. Electrical safety. Children can stick objects in open sockets and get hurt. Unused electrical outlets must have safety plugs to prevent accidental electrocution from foreign objects being put in the socket. Every home should have a fire extinguisher. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors should be on each floor of the home and tested monthly. Batteries should be changed at least every 6 months or as necessary. A working fire extinguisher must be accessible. Keep paper towels, plastic plates, plastic utensils, and anything other than cooking equipment away from the stove. These items can easily start a fire if left too close to the range. Keep pesticides and cleaners away from children. Store chemicals in a locked cabinet or keep on a high shelf that children cannot reach. Do not spray bug spray or pesticides near a child's toys, since toys tend to go into a child's mouth. In addition, never leave household chemicals unattended. Unfortunately, small children may try to open the products and drink the contents.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Royalty Free Music, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.